My talk this morning is called The Story of Two Songs. Thing is, songs are often poetry set to music. No one would ever say that I was a poetry aficionado. My level of poetry is usually about third grade. I remember a poem I had to memorize. It was called, Isabel, by a guy named Ogden Nash. It was, I can still remember most of it. Isabel, met a bear. Isabel, didn't care. She washed her hands and she did her hair up, and then Isabel kindly ate the bear up. That's about my level of poetry. But, you know, songs are fantastic, and they can lift you up, and they can bring you down. They can do all kinds of things. Sometimes I just sit in my office and listen to songs on YouTube, songs that make me feel happy, songs that bring me closer to the Lord. There's so much about poetry and about songs. You know, when, in a low time in my life, someone gave me a poem, and I read it, and it expressed how I felt. You know, I was going through a bad breakup, talking about loneliness and despair and all that sort of thing, and I just wanted to cry. I said, how does this person know how I feel better than I know how I feel? And the answer was, because they've lived it, because they've been through it too. So that's when poetry and songs actually came to importance in my life. Well, I want to tell you the story of two songs. Does anybody remember Paul Harvey? Okay. And the rest of the story? Today I have the rest of the story for you. Not about Paul Harvey. The funny thing about the story, it's about these two songs. It's about a man who wrote these two songs. He was born June 22nd, 1936. He was born into a wealthy family. He was a second-generation American from a military family. His father obtained the rank of Major General, which would be a two-star general. Pretty high up. There's only two ranks higher than that. Well, he moved around a lot being a military brat, and he graduated from San Mateo High School in California, which is a suburb of San Jose. He moved around all over during his childhood and didn't have a lot of close relationships. But after graduating high school, he goes to Pomona College, and he was recognized for his achievements in rugby, football, and track and field. And then he won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. And he went to Oxford and received a degree in English literature. Those of you in the educational field, you know, that's pretty high up, pretty lofty goal. But it was a military family, and he was expected to go in the military. So he did. He enlisted in the Army. He became a captain and a helicopter pilot. At the end of his tour as a helicopter pilot, he was offered a job as a professor teaching English literature at West Point. And he turned it down. He wanted to pursue music. And he left the Army. 1965, he left the Army. Well, this upset his family greatly. And they disowned him. They wouldn't have anything to do with him. In fact, in one interview, he said that he thought the one time he thought his family was proud of him was when he received that degree. Well, his mother, in a subsequent interview, reportedly said, "Well, it was true that they were proud of that accomplishment. It didn't make up for the disappointment he had always been to them." Sadly, they never reconciled. They never got back together. The family disowned him completely, and they died without ever making peace with each other. So this man had no relationship with his family, no prospects of a job. He wasn't a hit. He was struggling. After 4 years in 1969, he was still struggling. He had a lifestyle of drinking, drugs, and womanizing. And he wrote a song. In late 1969, he wrote a song of loneliness, despair, and sadness. The title of that song is called Sunday Morning Coming Down. He says, "Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt. And the beer that I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled through my closet for my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt. And I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I'd smoked my brain the night before on cigarettes and songs that I'd been picking, but I lit my first and watched a small kid cussing at a can that he was kicking. Then I crossed the empty street and caught the Sunday smell of someone's frying chicken. And it took me back to something that I'd lost somehow, somewhere along the way. In the park, I saw a daddy with a laughing little girl who he was swinging. And I stopped beside a Sunday school and listened to the song they were singing. Then I headed back for home, and somewhere far away, a lonesome bell was ringing, and it echoed through the canyons like the disappearing dreams of yesterday. On the Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing, Lord, that I was stoned, because there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. There ain't nothing short of dying half as lonesome as the sound on the sleeping city sidewalks, Sunday morning coming down." That is one depressing song. Let's take a look at it for a minute. This young man speaks of waking up at a time of day when most people were frying chicken for lunch. He had a hangover, drank beer to make himself feel better. Without a family or anyone else, he just tries to find a not-too-dirty shirt to put on, and he goes outside. And he sees families. He hears people singing in church. He smells that chicken. And it's too much. And he turns and heads back to his little apartment. He even wished that he was still drunk because the loneliness was more than he could take. So the song says there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And for him, it did. For a man without God in his life, it is as lonesome as the sound of Sunday morning coming down. That's 1969. This whole story takes place in about 2 years. That's how he was in his life, though. It was tough. So he got a job at, he goes to Nashville. Goes to a job, gets a job at Columbia Records, sweeping floors. He's a janitor. He also did, he was a helicopter pilot, and he managed to get some part-time work flying a helicopter for the oil fields, but the work was spotty and not very often. So one day, Johnny Cash walks in to record at that studio in Nashville. And the young janitor looked at him, he desperately wanted to give him this demo tape of that song. But to do so would mean getting fired. You can't walk up to stars and, you know, bother them. Well, Johnny's wife, June Carter Cash, came in with Johnny, and while Johnny was recording, she waited outside in the common area, and they struck up a conversation. And eventually, this young man gave her his demo tape and said, "Could you please give this to Johnny?" And she liked him, and she kind of enlisted, said, "Sure, I'll be happy to do that." And so she did. June played it for Johnny, but he was not interested, even with June's urging. So she reported back to the young man that no luck, you know, but she said, "I'll keep trying." Well, it wasn't too long after that he got a part-time day flying the helicopter. And he decided, you know what? He flew to Johnny Cash's house, sat down on the lawn, got out, and handed him the demo tape. Now, there's two versions of that. Johnny Cash said he handed him the tape. This young man says he didn't remember if Johnny was even home, but he knew that he gave him the tape. So, out of that sheer audacity of what he did, Johnny Cash decided to listen to the tape again, and he recorded it. Well, this took some months, and during those ensuing months, this janitor's life went on. Well, he was able to get some small gigs singing in different places, and in 1970, he went to, I think it was a small venue in New York with a guy named Bobby Newirth, but he met Janis Joplin. And anybody that knows Janis Joplin, she was the epitome of the crazy hippie flower child drinking and drugs movement. And he was convinced to go out to Larkspur, California, and he stayed in her house for a little while. You can imagine his lifestyle. So he said at this time, these are his words, "I dug her, but I had itchy feet, and I'd get up intending to get out, and in she comes with the early morning drinks, and pretty soon you're wasted enough that you don't care about leaving." But he wasn't there all that long, and he actually had co-written a song. He said, "Janis, you should record this." And it was me and Bobby McGee. And she didn't record it while he was there, and he left, and she recorded it later. This was the spring of 1970. By October of 1970, Janis Joplin died of a heroin overdose. So, this man didn't even know it. He said he was actually driving his car in early 1970 when he heard it on the radio for the first time. Posthumously, it was released, and he heard her singing his song. He said, "I pulled to the road, I couldn't drive anymore, and I cried and I cried." I can only imagine how much pain he must have been in, because his lifestyle was a dead end. There was no meaning, there's only sadness and pain. But Johnny's version of Sunday Morning came out, and he gained some fame and some notoriety for writing that song. And he got invited to play a benefit for Dottie West at her high school. It was a benefit for the high school. So he went. It was a few hours' drive. So him and some of the other people that were performing for that event traveled over to Dottie's high school. And one of those people was Connie Smith. She was a devoted country singer, but a devoted Christian. And she later gave up country music to focus exclusively on gospel music. But she invited this young man to church. I'm going to read you his own words. I want you to understand this is not a story, I'm going to say, of his salvation. This is a story of how this song came to be. And in his own words, he says, "Connie took me to church the next day, to Jimmy Snow's church, and I had a profound religious experience. Something that I never had happened to me before, and why me came out of it. Everybody was kneeling down, and Jimmy asked something like," he was very hesitant. He it was hard for him to tell this part. He said, "If anybody is lost, please raise their hand." And I was kneeling there. Now, I don't go to church a lot. And the notion of raising my hand, it's out of the question. Then all of a sudden, I felt my hand going up. And I was hoping that nobody else was looking, because everybody had their head bent over and they were praying. And then he said, if anybody is ready to accept Jesus or something like this, come down to the front of the church. And I thought, that'll never happen. And I found myself getting up and walking down with all these people and going down there. And I don't really know what he said to me. He said something like, are you ready to accept Jesus Christ into your life? Or something. And I said, I don't know. I didn't know what I was doing. And he put me down and he said, kneel down here. And I can't even remember what he's saying. But whatever it was such a release for me that I found myself weeping in public, uncontrollably. And I felt this forgiveness that I didn't even know I needed. And then he wrote the song, Why Me? It's been played by many famous singers, to include Elvis and Johnny Cash. And the most remarkable thing to me was the comments. I looked on YouTube, this one posting, and it was not posted by anybody special. It was just a random man posted a clip that he had recorded off of TV, but with the comments. This posting had 13 million views and over 5,000 comments. Many of them said how much this song helped them, how this song was the reason they became a Christian, how it saved them from suicide. And out of this man's journey, he found the depth to write the words of this song. And if you are to believe the comments, it has touched the lives of many, many people and brought some to Christ. I'd like to read you the words of this song. This is a very short song. He says, why me, Lord? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the pleasures I've known? Tell me, Lord, what did I ever do that was worth loving you or the kindness that you've shown? Tell me, Lord, if you think there's a way I can try to repay all I've taken from you. Maybe, Lord, I can show someone else what I've been through myself on my way back to you. Lord, help me, Jesus. I've wasted it so. Help me, Jesus. I know what I am. Now that I know that I've needed you so, help me, Jesus. My soul's in your hand. He wrote that in 1971, less than 2 years from the time he wrote the first song of Sadness and Despair. He went from a lonely, hungover Sunday to the humbling acceptance of his own sins and his belief in Jesus. The first song was despair and loneliness, and the second song, a humbled man ready to become a Christian. Now, I bet every person here over the age of 50 probably knows who I'm talking about. And I also bet everybody under the age of 50 probably doesn't. And when I tell you who it is, you can say, who's that? But he trust me, he became a very talented writer, published many songs, many albums. And from what I've read, till the last performance he ever gave, he's still alive, but to the last performance he ever gave, he closed his concerts with this song. His name is Kris Kristofferson. He was had a rough life sometimes. He was actually born wealthy, but he went through a really rough time. I'd like to read just a few comments from some of the ones that were listed on this website. A guy named Dan Snyder said, this song saved my life. I was a horrible drunk and a drug addict from the age of 15 till I turned 38 and laid on my deathbed. I've been clean and sober for nearly 19 years. And now I work for a place that helps others get clean and take back control of their lives. Jerome Kerwitt said, I heard this song when I was a 25-year-old atheist, and it added a little push and incentive for me to later call on Jesus. I'm still with Jesus at 66. Dave Farr said, this is just how the Lord works, is all you can say. Thanks, Chris, for bringing so many to the Lord with just one song. Someone named Koloff said, this is so moving, one of the purest, most innocent, raw testimonies you'll ever see. I was a heathen for 34 years, but I gave my life to Jesus in 1993. Another woman, Sarah Wood, said, I needed this today. I was in a personal crisis and remembered Chris's story. So, I wish I could tell you that Chris was baptized for the remissions of sins, that he followed the gospel and was a faithful member of the church for the rest of his days, but I don't know that. In fact, I suspect the opposite. I don't know what he did after that day or if he did continue in his faith. What I do know, is that everyone has to start somewhere, and this was his start. I hope he studied the Bible and was baptized for the remissions of sins and was obedient. I think it's fairly obvious from the telling of that day that he was in a Pentecostal type of church at that time. But it reminds me that we all have a journey, and I think many of us who've been raised in the church maybe never really understand. One of the things I learned when I started working in a jail, you know, so many of these people, they had rough lives. I know one guy whose mother signed them up on a school Christmas thing. You could sign up, say, we don't have enough money, and my child would like to have a new jacket for Christmas. And they were given a new jacket by the school. Still had the tags on it. Mom took the jacket back to Target, returned it for the money, and spent it on drugs. And that's what that person's childhood was like. So it's normal for me to not be cared about, to not have what I needed. My parents were only interested in getting drugs. They were only interested in their lives. We don't know what that feels like, many of us, and it's good that we don't. But when they start from such a low spot and can become a Christian, I want to make sure that we understand where they came from and how far they've traveled. Sometimes I think that those of us that are raised in the church don't realize, others don't understand everything that we do about the gospel or about the Bible. You know, in Philippians chapter 1, verses 15 through 18, it says, it is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice. I don't know Jimmy Snow's motivation for what he did, but I do know that although this may not be a story of someone's salvation, it is not for me to judge the state of his soul. But I know that this man, Chris Christopher, reached a point where he realized how much he had sinned. He knew he needed help. He acknowledged the beauty of God and Jesus' love, and he was humbled. And the result of that day was a song that has reached millions of people. I think of Hannah in the Old Testament, who had a problem that was not of her own making. She couldn't have children. She was having such a hard time. And Peninnah made fun of her. This is 1 Samuel chapter 1. Peninnah made fun of her because Peninnah, his other wife, had plenty of children and would belittle Hannah for her inability to have children. And Hannah prayed, and she prayed so much She was so upset she couldn't eat. She prayed so hard that Eli thought she was drunk. And she vowed to the Lord to devote her child to the Lord if she could just have one child. And the Lord remembered her and she conceived. Because she prayed for the right reasons from the depth of her soul. And then, the section that Mark wrote this morning, I wanted to talk on that, about the sinner and the tax collector. You know, it said he couldn't approach the altar. He went in the parable about the Pharisee and the tax collector. The Pharisee stood there and said, you know, I'm glad I'm not like these people. I'm glad that I'm not a drunk. I'm not one of these people that has done that. And thank you for making me such a great person. But the tax collector, I mean, what were tax collectors? They worked for the Romans collecting taxes. They went to people and said, you owe this much money. And they were infamous for graft and for stealing. They were the used car salesman or internet scammer of today. They were known for being shady and gouging people. And this tax collector in Luke, he couldn't even approach the temple. It says he stood at a distance. He couldn't look up towards heaven when he prayed. He stared at the ground and he said, God have mercy on me, a sinner. And in verse 14, it says very clearly that that man, the tax collector, not the Pharisee, he went home made right with God because he humbled himself. I can only imagine how low that man must have felt, where he didn't even feel worthy to approach the temple. He didn't even feel worthy to get close. But he reached a point where he knew that he was wrong. And he was convicted in his own heart of his sins. And he turned to God and he begged for forgiveness. My lesson today is that I hope that each and every one of you reaches a point in your life where you can be like Hannah, who turned to God for something she was powerless to change. Or like the tax collector, who knew he had sinned and recognized he didn't deserve, nor was he entitled to salvation, yet he prayed and he hoped for God's grace. And like Chris, who wonders at the awesomeness of God to have reached out to save us from the result of our sins. Chris realized he needed help, and he recognized that Jesus was the answer. May we reach a point where we stop and realize our sins, where we know that we need Jesus in our life, where out of the depths of that despair, Christ's glory can be revealed. May we never be like the Pharisee, looking down on others because we think we are in the right, and that we're better than someone else. So if anyone today would like to come forward, we're going to offer a song of invitation. And if you've decided that today is the day to recognize Jesus as your Savior, we invite you to come forward, confess His name, and be baptized for the remission of sins. Thank you for your time.